This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
All right, Monday morning Q&A. We are going to be going over three cases today. David, we're also going to be talking about Koberger. We're also going to be talking about the Delphi situation and the latest there. So be sure to drop your questions in the comments section as we work through this on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you may be watching us live. And thank you over the weekend. If you drop those, we're going to try and get to as much as we possibly can today. We're going to start with the David case this morning. Everything about this case gets heavier, it seems, by the day. The People's Brief made public what prosecutors say David Anthony Burke did to Celeste Rivas Hernandez. That came out last week. If you've not seen that or read that, oh my goodness. We got videos on it, reading directly through it, breaking it down. Go back in the archive just last week and you can get all of that. There's so much in this. The alleged calculation, the staged text, the fake name, the months that passed while a 14-year-old girl's body sat in a parked Tesla and cooked. And the man prosecutors say put her there, went on tour, did radio interviews, threw an album release party, and behind all of it, a child who was 11 years old when she met him. Your questions have been pouring in since it dropped, so we're going to try and get to those. Joining me, as always, to discuss, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's jump into it. Let's start here. It just kind of gets to the behavior. And I think a lot of people are just trying to wrap their mind around this guy, Robin. He allegedly went on an album, went on to an album release party, had an album release party the night after prosecutors believe she was murdered. Like nothing happened. The question is quite simple. What kind of person does that?
Psychopath.
I mean, yeah.
Psychopath. I mean, literally, it's just psychopathy. And I want to say just psychopathy. But again, it's not licensed clinician. We haven't seen any testing on him, but some that can compartmentalize. And I don't even like the word compartmentalize because it's not like it's all wrapped up into one for people like this. It's just like Gilgo Beach, you know, and Rex Heuerman, you know. Asa thought, you know, that's not the family man I know. I want to get to know the other guy. No, it's all one dude that was just faking it in front of you. Same thing here. This guy just has zero empathy for any other human being except himself, because no other human being can do what he did. This thing, as you said, it's getting darker and darker and more twisted every single day. It's shocking. It's probably one of the most shocking cases outside of Maddie Soto that we've covered in my mind when it comes to just horrendous tragedy. And just stupidity. I mean, this is like one of the, I say this all the time, not one of these people that commits any of these horrendous crimes is smart. I don't care what their IQ says. They have zero emotional intelligence. And if they had any semblance of intelligence, and this guy's had enough, he's successfully making music. So what would make someone that is successfully making music do something so stupid? And not just the horrendous act of killing someone, innocent to proven guilty, the horrendous act of killing someone, but the method of it was like the dumbest way, the cover up, everything. This is just like so idiotic what he did. And for what gain? Nothing except mental breakdown, dumb brain, broken brain.
I feel like we need another word for compartmentalization. Because it's like we all can compartmentalize things to a certain extent. And then there's some who can do it really well. And like that gets up there, you know, into like the narcissism world. This is like lock boxes that are separated. I don't know what it is. It's so separated, and so he has the ability to navigate his way going forward without recognizing, you know, I guess what the hell's in those compartments. And maybe that's the shocking part of compartmentalization for so many, is like, we think, you know, you can compartmentalize something, but it's still there. It's still over there. And the weight of the horrificness of it still shines through, even though it's compartmentalized over here. Whatever the hell he's doing, he's locking it off so good that he can show up to have parties and do this and that, like nothing is going on. Another thing that kind of came to mind here, thinking about the day after, Corey Richens, another case that obviously we've talked about a lot.
Exactly.
The day after her husband died, she goes and she closes on that house. There's video of her. I mean, their friends had like a little celebration party, which number one to me seemed crazy because that was more than one. That was more than just her having a celebration there. There was like multiple friends like, hey, let's celebrate. Let's hang out and have drinks. Like her husband just died like the day before. And you're all like joking around the kitchen. Like what? There's something seriously wrong with these people or anybody that's able to move on from a tragic death, and the next day you're having cocktails and living it up. I mean, I get when it's grandma and she's 95 and you're celebrating life, but not when unexpected your daughter or your girlfriend or your husband dies out of nowhere under suspicious circumstances.
You know, one of the psychs on my team years ago gave a great analogy, and I know I've used it here before, and I'll use it again because I think it really fits, because we keep trying to put human conditions on inhuman people.
Yeah.
These people are not human. They are pure predator. And what I mean by that is, so let's do our little thought experiment. Think of a wolf, think of a lion, especially a wolf, because wolves kill for pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, if they're thirsty, they can go down to the water hole and drink amongst all the other animals that they're about to go kill free of emotion, because it's always just serves them. That's it. There's no compartmentalization with a wolf. They just are. They kill for pleasure. They kill for food. They kill for sport. They just kill, yet they can actually blend into the environment when they need to, because if they got to get some water, if they don't feel like killing today, and this, and it just it, that is the only analogy you can really use with the pure predator that is missing this. They're just missing the empathy gene. They're missing any need to or human connection, because they are just a predator that gets their dopamine fix and hit from the kill.
That's an interesting thought. I mean, and maybe that's something that we need to understand more with people. And we don't look at people that way. We look at wolves like he could be a predator. It could be or he can be loving and kind and raising his cubs and pack and being good and you know, and surviving as a wolf would survive. I mean, more wolves, you know, are out there in the woods, in the forest, and far more never attack a person. Every once in a while, you got one that does. People are kind of the same way to a certain extent. I mean, I guess there's empathetic wolves, but you push any wolf to a, you know, the breaking point or a threat.
Wolves are kinder.
They could be. Yeah, I think you're right. I think wolves might be kinder. But it's kind of like that. People are really the same way. We are shocked all the time by people doing these sort of things. But, you know, we're not surprised when we see a wolf tore somebody apart. Should we really be that surprised when people are doing it? Where it's like, yeah, they're capable of that too. They're not all empathetic, kind, you know, hearted things.
Well, the good news is the majority of us are.
Yeah.
It's just the broken ones that when they're broken, they're broken. It's not even broken. It's just missing. The empathy is missing. That's why trying to figure out a psychopath, you're wasting your time. There's nothing to figure out because there's nothing there. They're not plotting. They're not strategizing. I mean, they are just living in the moment, and they'll strategize how to do things. But you can see some of the thought processes going on here. You know, Rex Humeran says it's his playtime. Who says that? Someone without empathy in his own house, 12 feet from or a couple feet from where his daughter's playing video games, is where he did all his kills.
Yeah.
And I mean, every single one of these wackadoos, nutters, is made exactly the same way. It's what they're missing, each one of them. And David, innocent to proven guilty, has exactly the same footprint that all the other ones did. And his immaturity, though, his age, and is really shining through with his immense stupidity. I mean, you and I were just reveling, thinking about this, you know, before we started. What moron buys a chainsaw to cut up a body? It flies everywhere. I'm just
someone who's never used a chainsaw, you know, like a 19-year-old. Like, you know?
So he saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre and thought that was a good idea.
Or he played with one in a video game once.
The things he did.
And just until a couple of weeks ago, your children could have been playing as David on Fortnite.
They probably still are.
That's the fun part. I wonder if you bought the skin, if you can still use that one, or if they're like, yeah, maybe.
Don't even use that word. That bought the skin.
That's whatever you call it, the avatar or whatever. Let's get another question here, and this is interesting because this. I'll read the question. Her parents took her phone away to protect her, and then he allegedly paid a kid at her school to deliver a new one. Paid a kid allegedly $1,000 to give her a new cell phone because mom and dad did step up here in this, in one of the few ways I will say I'll give them some credit for of parenting. The question from the listener is, how am I supposed to feel safe sending their own daughter to school? Well, be involved in your kid's life, is the answer. Be present. Be aware. I'm still going through. I have a young teenager right now. Robin, you've gone through this. You've got them out of the house. They have survived and they have grown to adulthood. You've gone through all of these years. How do you answer that?
Same what you just said. Communication. Every time. It's a tricky balancing act because every time something would come up that was potentially challenging, the only ones that would really get all my attention were the ones when we start dealing with potentially unhealthy people. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know there's unhealthy people yet until there is a wobble in the behavior of your child. And I mean, I am so hypersensitive to wobbles. And wobbles are a deviation from what you normally expect. Granted, teenagers have wobbles every single day, but those wobbles are going to hit a pattern as well. Yeah. But anytime you start seeing differences in communication that can't be attributed to something, bad grades at school, a typical teenage breakup or a typical teenage drama. But how do you know all that? Transparency. We got our kids in a pattern earlier in age because habits are always repeatable. And we got our kids in a habit of constantly sharing, even when they didn't feel like it. It's just constantly sharing. It's always a help me understand this. I always start out with a validation of saying, listen, help me understand. You've made a lot of great choices and you have a lot of really great friends in your life. And one of the things I value about you is all your friends. I enjoy knowing them, enjoy seeing them. Help me understand what you see here. I'm struggling to see what you see. I don't understand this behavior. Help me understand this behavior that they're doing and help me understand how this is good for you. I mean, it's always just curiosity. And if I didn't get an explanation that made sense with transparency and openness, then we had a different conversation. And it only happened once where it deviated into me pressing harder, and it was a struggle because the thing I'm always saying to myself at all, and whether it was with my kids or anything in life, is how is what I'm about to do or say going to help or hinder a healthy relationship? Because healthy relationship's going to win the day. If you have a healthier relationship with your kids where their dopamine is flowing at home, they're not going to need their dopamine flowing outside the house. Mm-hmm. So if you win the big four battle in their brain, endorphins, serotonin, oxytocin, and dopamine at home, they don't have to get that fix outside the house. It's not said they're not going to have that. That's why we do sports. That's why we do theater. It's why we have all these great experiences. But the anchor of those emotions, those positive emotions where they feel safe, where they feel heard, and they feel valued and not judged, is home. Mm-hmm. That's how you have the communication you need to mitigate wobbles.
Yeah.
Long explanation. I know I'm sorry, but
no, I agree.
Is the key.
And I will say this. I mean, because as a parent, I think the the thing I think a lot of us were brought up with was, well, if something is being a hazard or something is troublesome, just take it away. That's what we had happen to us.
Corks too.
but the thing is, I mean, at this day and age, not all the time it does. I mean, especially with devices like phones.
Yeah, they've been
stuff.
Determined to use it. They're going to
use it. Well, they'll get one. They're, mm-hmm. Someone will give them one. They will find one. They will buy one. Even like they will find a way. I mean, just think of how crafty everyone, like we've all been in our teen years. Like, that didn't go away. They're still crafty, craftier probably than we are. And they will find a way. So it's more so to me, like with a device, like my reaction, my knee jerk is always like, take it away. I'm like, wait a second, take a step back here, Tony. This is like the communication. Like this is the avenues to which they use it. If I take that away, I lose all control over that device and also intercepting any information that comes through it should I need to. I'm in the dark if I just take that away. They'll find another way that I really don't know anything about or may not know about. If I catch it, great. But if not, you're just creating more problems. If they need their device, they need their device. You can limit their device. There's all sorts of limitations you can put on this thing. But just taking it away doesn't necessarily usually solve the problem other than for that exact instant. If you can find a way to monitor that device, let them use it. But then you're getting the information as a parent as you need it, should there be anything questionable going on. You know, use the resources that are in existence out there to help figure out what's going on with your children and monitor as you see fit and as you need as a parent, rather than you're just putting up roadblocks. Sometimes I think when you're taking things like that away, then you are actually finding ways of dealing with the issue and trying to get ahead of it and find healing or inspiring them in some way, shape or form.
So I'm going to give you some Jedi level stuff that I was fortunate enough that wound up happening in our house and still does to this day with that kind of thing. Because you're right. If you say you can't, it's not going to stop anyone who says they want to.
Yeah.
We see this in murders. You know, I mean, you can protect a president. You can protect you can do anything you want. But if someone's been determined to do harm, they're going to do harm.
Yeah.
So the key is, how do you inspire them to not want to do harm? How do you inspire them to want to share? How do you inspire them to come up with a solution on their own? That's what I did. So I always came down to, as everyone on the show knows, I'm anti-nutter. I don't do crazy. I don't do crazy relationships. It's being around unhealthy people is the most draining experience in life, and I don't do it. And so anytime one of my kids or anyone in my life was having drama issues, what we had conversations about what causes drama. And what behaviors cause drama. And then so it was never a judge of this was right or this wrong, or you can't do this and you can't see this person. It was just us assessing as a group, as a family, or the two of us, hey, let's take a look at this. Let's look at the data that you're collecting. Let's look at how do you feel? What is going on that makes you feel that way? Who is making you feel that way? That person? All right. So what do you want to do about it? What would make this better? Oh, it's the social networking that's doing it. All right, so you tell me, is that something you need help with? Or do you need to use me as an excuse with your friends that you can't do this because my dad said I can't do this? What you need me to do to be a resource in your life to give you permission to get rid of the drama that's making you feel this way? Because it's a choice. Do you want to feel this way? No? What can we do about it? Yeah. And it was team. And I never took anything away from my kids. I didn't have to. Yeah. They made the choice. They need to cut something out. I became a resource for them, an excuse. I remember every time my kids would go to a potential party or a get together, my wife and I told our kids, hey, if you need to make a phone call and tell them that my parents are angry, you know, if you need to make us the excuse why you don't feel comfortable to leave, we're here.
Yeah.
So it's always just a deep conversation about what you're feeling, what you're going through, what the solution could be, and what can we do together to mitigate it so you're not put in that position.
Harper's used me as an excuse before, too. She's been on the phone like, oh, my dad says, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I never said this. And then she hangs up. She's like, no, it's fine. Like, I know that. But she's like, I wanted it. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, yeah. Like, yeah, she's like arrives to that sometimes by herself.
It's a team. It's a team. You know, I say this with my kids all the time. I'm their chief of staff. Once they hit the age where they decided what it is they wanted to do for their own prosperity in life, my job is to help them get there. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the snowplow. I'm not the helicopter. I'm the guy behind the scenes that said, this is the destination you set. I'm going to be your loving critic and ask the questions about what you're doing. About what you're doing, is this helping or hindering you getting from point A to point B, the choice that you made? And if you don't like it, then choose a different choice. If you don't want me as your chief of staff, that's fine too. I am here to support you in the decisions you're making on the healthy path and road that you're trying to forge. If I see wobbles, I'll point out the wobble. If you don't want me to, I won't do that as well. It always comes back to, I am their greatest fan, their greatest advocate, and their chief of staff. And they feel guilty when they don't share stupid shit with me. And that's what keeps these wobbles from happening. I don't sweat it. I look forward to deep conversations when things go sideways. I don't look forward to the pain they go through, but we don't think of it as pain anymore either. These are life reps. This is going to be a great rep. We're going to take something great from this. And I guarantee you, you know, to either my kids, you won't do this the same way the second time. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Robin's latest book, by the way, It's Not All About Me, available.
On Self-Help Mondays.
On Self-Help Mondays, yes, available wherever you get books. Go check it out. Your thoughts there in Substack and YouTube. Let's move over to another case that we continue to watch. Four families buried their children. Brian Koberger admitted that he did it, and somehow, nearly 4 years later, the questions are getting louder with some, not necessarily quieter, at least with one author. Christopher Whitcomb has a new book out. He's a retired FBI agent, and he claims he's pulling back the curtain on evidence that was never tested. Chain of custody problems that could have gutted the prosecution's case, and a university that allegedly watched a predator escalate and did nothing. These are the claims he's making. Koberger waived his right to an appeal. He gave no motive, and he offered no explanation. And we both had a chance to get into the book over the weekend. I'm going to start there. Because there's questions about, there's a lot of questions about the book. I just did a monologue about it that's going to be coming out later in the week that kind of goes through the whole damn book and debunks a lot of it, because there's a lot in this book that really needs debunking, and claims that are made in this book that have already been either litigated or can be so ridiculously easily explained away that it's not worthy of the breath in which it takes to even discuss them, because it's already been discussed and doesn't need to be reviewed 50 times over. Robin, what's been your thoughts on the book so far?
As Tony knows, this has been a long weekend of diving into this book. I'm sorry, Tony, I didn't mean to correct you, but he's not a retired FBI. He's former FBI.
FBI.
He quit after 15 years.
Okay,
my bad. So what I was actually analyzing how I analyze this weekend with this book. So I'll start there. And so when new information comes out that is contrary or something, I typically don't look at the information first. I look at who the information is coming from, and I do a deep dive on those people first. And so I did a deep dive on this author to gain an understanding of his context, his motivations, his intent of what he's trying to do before I look at what he actually did. So it's 15 years in a bureau, roughly, 4 years in a small office as an agent, as a street agent, in a very small office. Very limited time as an investigator. From there, he moved on to the hostage rescue team, part of Ruby Ridge. And so he was kicking down doors, being very kinetic in his career.
Sure.
And not doing investigation. From there, he went to Quantico and taught new agents interviewing skills. And then because last year's after that, he did something else in management. So anyway, only 4 years on the street as an investigator, no legal background, no legal training, has done no commentary on true crime, never followed true crime, never followed this case, never commented on it. And so that's the background of him that I looked at. The challenge I had with this one was, what's the intent? And so his stated intent in the book is to shine light, and he felt he had a moral obligation because these facts weren't flushed out in court. They needed to be flushed out in court. He stated he believed Koberger was guilty. Okay. and he felt a moral obligation. But here is what I did the deep dive of understanding. Again, Bob Mata and our great Eric Richens would do a better job as well. And that is the fact that when you look at the intent of these things that need to be fleshed out, it's an irrelevant point. And here's why. Ann Taylor, the lead defense attorney, that's her job. Her job, number one, her moral and ethical challenge that she is obligated to do, and this is across the board, is to save the life of her client who's under threat of death penalty. That's the number one thing her job is. And as she's going through her process, and we covered it on this show, and everyone did too. I was nervous many times, as we both were, because we thought he was guilty, even though innocent until proven guilty. But she was doing a really, really, really good job, being one of only two attorneys in that state that are death penalty certified to stand on this case with, I think, 30 years as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney. I mean, she's got a lot of reps. And so she was doing everything she could to take all that evidence that he was given 59,000 documents by someone who broke the confidentiality agreement that he had signed with Ann Taylor's team. In other words, he broke a moral and ethical and legal. He's probably going to face some civil litigation that is being hinted by Ann Taylor's team for what he did to further the fact that they say these things weren't fleshed out like they should have been in court, even though we think he was guilty. Mm-hmm. But here's the main problem with that argument is that it wasn't supposed to yet. As Ann Taylor is going through the evidence and seeing, again, it's her call and her team's call about whether to accept a guilty plea or not, or whether to plead guilty or not. And as the evidence is coming in, she's saying, my number one obligation is to save his life, and I don't think I can do it because of X, Y, and Z. So it never got its day in court. Why? Because she knew she wasn't going to win in court, so let's plead guilty. Mm-hmm. It's a moot point. And also, the other thing I looked at too, if his stated obligation was because he felt morally and ethically compelled that these things should be fleshed out, he actually, if you look at the stats on this, he picked the most ineffective route you could possibly do it by publishing a book. Other ways he could have done it is that I pulled them all right up here. Escalate internally with defense team, pre-plea, you formal a resignation, documented concerns, anonymized professional or peer-reviewed channels, policy or legislative advocacy, protected ethics and consultation and whistleblower route. And those would give him a much better route for actually challenging the fact that they weren't fleshed out in court, which there was no obligation to flesh them out in court because they pled before they had a chance to flesh them out in court. Anyway. Yeah. I'm no legal guy, but that's what I found out.
There's a lot. Yeah. It's one of those things where I said, I do the audiobook. I know you do the audiobook. And I looked at it from the beginning. It's like, oh, it's 12 hours. Time is one thing neither of us have a lot of. So we're trying to find ways of getting books in when we read them. And I think we got a few hours in and we're like,
we did.
Like, I can't waste more time on this.
I tried so hard.
I can't, because I don't have time to just hear somebody else go drone on and on about things that are easily disprovable. One of the big things in this book is the chain of custody with the knife sheath is what he's, it's making a mountain out of a molehill, and it's not even a molehill, because once you just look at the details, there's no molehill to be had. They digitally scan all of their items. So you want to talk about a detailed log of who has what? That's it. It's far more detailed than somebody with a pen and a piece of paper. But the big thing that's being argued in the book is, well, see, it was all written in pen. This looks like the same person on the same day on a sheet. Yeah, they're transcribing the digital log so you can physically see it. That's all that is. It's not supposed, it's a supplement. It doesn't even need to be there technically. It just is. So
and here's a problem with that too, Tony, is I doubt from his background, he's actually ever done a chain of custody himself.
Well, it takes 2 seconds to figure this out.
And he also never interviewed one person outside of the person that gave it to him and one anonymized other FBI person. That's it. There's no consultation. There's no due diligence. There was no, he had no loving critic.
Here's another one that got me on the book. And then I'm going to go to some of the questions. You're fine. And this is what told me a lot about it. Cause this wasn't like, this is a book. that you're putting out, an audiobook that's being put out. You know, you polish that shit. You don't just like go with like your first take unless it's flawless. If you're putting out something for publishing, T's are crossed, I's are dotted. If you're missaying a word, you go say it right. Especially one of the victims' names.
Gonzalez.
Gonzalez. And like, I get it. We fucked up the name 1,000 times
and
on the show.
And I said every time I did too, because it's a hard, it's a hard one to pronounce.
And usually, and it was usually towards more the beginning of a case. Like when you're starting to learn people's names and you're reporting on it early on. Like that's when that sort of thing happens. So I get it. I get it when people do screw it up, and I think you can have grace there. But when you're publishing the book, when you're actually, this is the final, this is the refined piece that is not live, that's not just as you're getting the information and as you're learning it, the entire damn book, Gonclaves.
And so,
like, yeah, we couldn't check the name, the enunciation of the fucking victims' names.
Here's what really is stunning to me on that one. So I've written 4 books, and I've been the narrator for each of the 4. I have it, you know, when, and he's with a big publisher on this one. He's an imprint of Harper, I think.
Yeah.
And so what happens? So here's how the sausages make when you're doing your own audiobook, and you're the narrator. You have a director. That director stops you every time you mispronounce a word. And if they don't know the spelling of the word, or if they don't know the pronunciation, what the director does is they look it up online and they listen to it online for the correct pronunciation. I can't tell you the number of times I had to, in sizing people up, I was saying trust but verify in Russian. That took me a lot of takes to get that run right down. And so the director should have stopped them, said you're pronouncing that name wrong, if they had done due diligence even on that. But their lack of knowledge of this case,
and
anyone involved in it, and even the director that didn't correct them is like, hey, let's double check this pronunciation of that. I mean, I've been stopped so much when narrating my books to make sure I had the pronunciation right. Even when I said, no, I'm 100% sure, the director said, let me just double check it again. And they didn't do that. It's crazy.
I was shocked by it. I mean, I've narrated audiobooks of my own. I've done other
That's
people's.
Right, yeah.
And it's just, I do audio all day. It's not books. But like, if there's something, a word and it stands out to me, when I saw Gonzalez, I needed to look it up. I needed to go, because I didn't know how to say it correctly. And that's fine if you don't know. Look it up. And especially at this point in the damn game. We're 4 years into this case. You just look up the case. Steve's talked 1,000 times. You'll find it within 3 seconds if you choose to look. And if you're going to go publish a fucking book, learn how to say the victim's names, you fucking imbecile. That's my take on it.
Go to the sentencing. You can listen to the judge calling him by his name at the sentencing. You know, I mean,
it's insult. It just shows lack of concern or care for the material to which you're presenting. And if you can't present the name of the victims correctly, I'm supposed to take you seriously on chain of custody on something that is also easily disprovable. I just don't fucking buy it. I don't know. Anyway.
And then it gets back to, so what do I think about the content? I don't care.
I don't care either.
Because it was like, all right, I won't even refute it. Because if it came from the 59,000 documents, all right, so okay. He says it is. So we have to take his word for it, because it wasn't ever peer reviewed by anyone or loving critics. So I'll just assume it. But you know what? It doesn't even matter, because it's a moot point, because it wasn't supposed to go to trial. That's why the defense has you sign confidentiality agreements that you can't disclose. You can't do exactly what he did because of this reason. It's not supposed to yet. Now, if gone to a court, if it actually been on part of the case, then you can do this because, hey, we didn't cover this. It got the wrong expert, or it wasn't covered, and whatever. But it didn't reach that because they pled because they thought they're going to lose and he would have been executed.
Yeah.
So it doesn't even make it to that point yet. Like, so everything in the book is completely irrelevant to me. I don't care what's in the book.
There are a few interesting nuggets in the book that I'd like to do a piece on. We won't do it here today. Like, I found some of the letters, the very short letters The whole reason I actually got the book is because I wanted the context of the letters, which are like literally like three lines. I thought maybe they were a bit deeper, but they're not. So if you're like, ooh, I'm going to read the in-depth letter from Brian Koberger to his dog, it's like a tweet.
it's less than a tweet. You're right.
I mean, I've done tweets much longer. I mean, and then the letters to his parents also incoherent and weird and like the size of a tweet. That's what I really wanted to dig into because I thought, oh, this could be an interesting psychological angle of this. Maybe we'll do something on that. But they're telling in another way. And they speak to me of someone who is so deep into his bullshit that he's almost speaking a different language. We're getting into like utter delusional territory here. Just quickly on that angle of it, what was your take on the weird, the letter to his dog, the letter to his parents? Like he's psycho, like he's talking about, and I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately, but it's like he's talking telepathically to his dog in one of the letters.
Yeah.
I
got it right here. I can try to pull it up really quick.
Oh my God. Like what is going on in this guy's mind? You know, he always thinks he's so too smart for the room, it seems, but this is like a new level of like, you're too smart for the room. And it's like he's fully embraced his bullshit almost. What was your thoughts?
The first thing about talking to the dog. So when it comes to people like this, some psychologists do, it's a control issue because it's easier to control pets. And so you form an easier bond with pets because you can control them and they give you that unconditional validation.
Sure.
And so that's the emotional angle on that one, most likely. And that whole, you know, pack mentality buddy thing, his writing style and speaking style has always been the same because he's so devoid of real emotion and real connection. Remember, we saw this throughout the case, well, throughout the buildup and the leakage and everything. He doesn't know how to be a human. Mm-hmm. So he studies how to communicate and how to do things as a human, but he can't pull it off. So one of the greatest things we have as a human being is we pick up on things that make us feel creepy in other human beings. And the creepy comes, the emotion we have about creepy with someone is because there's an incongruence between words, actions, and deeds. There's an incongruence. And he is the epitome because he's trying to say the right words, but he's completely devoid of the emotion that backs him up because he's empty. It's not that he hates you. It's not that he feels disdain towards you. He feels nothing towards you. And he's trying to fake being a human by trying to pick the right words because he studied what he should say or not say. That's why he comes across as so formal. He doesn't know how to speak. He's an empty shell of a moron. The only way I'd believe in alien life on this planet is him. He's an alien. He's placed here in a shell and he's got someone inside working the switches, trying to get him to speak.
He's like a bad early version of ChatGPT.
Yes. Did you ever watch one of the funniest movies ever I used to love was When Mars Attacks? Yeah. and then they got the robots in there controlling the humans.
Yeah.
That's him.
It's kind of like that. Like, maybe that's the answer to all of true crime. They're all aliens. They're all aliens.
Well, they're not human. They're inhuman. Remember, we use that term with the ones that do the horrendous things for children. Soul rippers.
Soul rippers, yeah. I hesitate to like, because I feel like that makes it more difficult to try and get into the psychology of it is when we say they're not human. But I do it too all the time. But that's like, it seems to be the most accurate way of describing these ways of thinking because it's not human, but it is. I mean, for some it is, for some people it is. And I think maybe that is the roadblock that we have so much with people like this is because it is so feeling unhuman to us. But the reality is, and we have to accept this, is there's a good chunk of human beings that do not act remotely human.
They have the biology of a human, but they don't have the psychology of a human.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge disconnect there. And if they could figure out what broke that, then we wouldn't have any more nutters like this.
We would solve the world's problems like that. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, especially if you bought the book or listened to it. I'm sorry, you're never going to get that $13.
Actually,
back.
I tried returning it this morning.
You can do that on Audible, can't you? Like that.
I'm trying.
I might. I always have so many damn credits on Audible.
I've never done that before on a book. I probably read about 60 books a year. I've never ever done that except this one. Is it? I can't. I even texted Tony. I said, you know, I'm going to go. He's like, I got to give up on this book. I said, I'm not going to give up. And I yeah. this morning. I tried.
All right. Well, if you're officially giving up, I'm officially giving up too.
We give each other permission.
Yeah. I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. Your thoughts on the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Let's talk about Delphi for a moment here. Abby Williams was 13. Ooh. Libby German was 14. They went for a walk on a bridge in Delphi, Indiana. If you want a case, anybody out there who's looking for a case to put some energy behind of someone wrongfully convicted, this might be it. Their families have spent over 9 years waiting for answers, real answers, not the one the state of Indiana has packaged for them. Richard Allen is now serving 130 years for their murders, but his defense team just filed their reply brief and requested something the state probably didn't want: oral arguments in front of a 3-judge panel. They're asking the Court of Appeals to hear this case out loud in person with all the constitutional issues laid bare. The court now decides whether to grant that request, and the question that keeps echoing through every filing, every exclusion, every harmless error the state has invoked is this: if the evidence was really this strong, why did they have to hide so much of it? And that's what we're going to get into here today. Let's just start, you know, the big one that the state continues to hang their hat on and go, harmless error, but they're not even saying this is an error. They're saying his confessions were completely reliable, and we've talked about this a lot, but if you're just joining the party of Richard Allen in the Delphi case, one of the questions here says, why did he say he shot the two girls who were never shot? That's the confession they're saying is, see, he admitted. Wouldn't a guilty person at least know how they did it? Karen on Instagram says that. Yeah, I mean, if you're getting a confession from somebody, Robin, and they confess to a crime that wasn't committed, or the modality, the method of the actual crime is not what they're saying they did, how is that accepted? I mean, in any way, shape, or form of like, oh, this seems legit.
I have no idea. It was just, this case is out of, man, we cover such incredible cases, but this one is the greatest travesty of justice. So I go back to behavior on this one first. Mm-hmm. You know, so someone is accused of something, and the first thing I do is, well, let's look at the arc. Let's look at the life. Let's look at the patterns and see if this fits a pattern or doesn't fit a pattern. For him, for this man, Richard Allen, killing two girls did not fit any way, whether it's knife, strangulation, shot, whatever it was. And it was not with a gun, which he said, which he confessed to first. It is completely out of the pattern for who he was as a man, as a husband, and as a father for his entire life arc. His focus outwardly on his well-being of his family, completely out of character for anyone that has committed a murder. Anyone. I dare anyone to find anyone who was so compassionately worried about his family that actually was guilty as he was. So that's the first thing. And then you actually have the duress that he suffered in solitary, which any psychologist will tell you the mental trauma and subjugation that happens to your brain when you're in solitary confinement, like he was, basically tortured, does things to your brain that shouldn't happen, and you'll do anything to end the torture. That's why torture is not admissible. It's why you can't do it, because it causes stupid things to come out of your mouth, because you'll do anything to get out of that suffering. And you'll also do, if you have a pattern of behavior, being outwardly focused and caring for your wife that you've been married to for so long, as well as your daughter, you'll do anything to end their suffering because of what's going on with you. So that's the first thing. And so that just makes you look deeper, make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and then that's where the entire thing starts falling apart. So the improbability of him doing this is the first thing I looked at, and then how they actually conducted the case is the huge travesty. You know, the missing calls, the things that everything from left, right, upside down. The inappropriateness of how law enforcement handled this, didn't handle it. The judges, the whole thing was just a train wreck from the get-go, and the man's in jail forever. And so even if you say we're going to accept that he said he's guilty, in other words, and also he didn't plead guilty. Mm-hmm. If he is actually guilty, think about this. Koberger pled guilty because he was guilty and he couldn't win. And in this case, he never pled guilty, even though they say he confessed. But you know why he didn't plead guilty? He wasn't. His lawyers didn't believe he was. And it was just, anyway.
Well, and you can't accept he never pled guilty. And when you torture someone and they eventually say, I did it, but they're identifying the wrong means of the actual crime, that's not exactly a confession. But if you want to mold it into that and say it is, Indiana, apparently that's what they like to do. Like, facts be damned. It's just check the box. Can you get him to say it? Okay, check the box, and we're going to stand behind that no matter what.
And besides the other people that actually fit the profile of someone that would have done this that they totally ignored, that's the big thing that really got me on this case and gets everyone that thinks he's innocent, is that they ignored the people, one, that confessed behind jail, behind bars, that he did do it, and the neighbor who actually had a history of doing this with kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And let's not look at the higher probability of who this could have been. Let's go for the guy that had a zero probability of who this could have been, because we think he might look like the guy on the bridge, even though
he looks nothing like the guy on the bridge. Even though the sketch looks nothing like him, and the woman who sat there and had the sketch done said, this is 100% him. This looks exactly like the guy I saw, to the sketch artist. And now we're seeing video of the sketch being done and the sketch artist going, oh, well, we can cheat. We can cheat as we make. Like, I don't think that should ever be part of the conversation when we're making a sketch for convicting someone as, we can cheat. Like, what? What?
And I get it. There's a lot of he's guilty guys and folks out there, and that's fine. I'm not going to argue that. But here's what we need to argue. Then why didn't they look at the other two to flesh it out? So then let's focus on the victims. Mm-hmm. The victims want to know that the right person's behind bars, that this person is serving there's justice been done for the murders that were committed of their little girls. This leaves too much guesswork. I mean, it's a guess. It's a wild ass guess that we got it right when they didn't flush out, because that's what didn't happen. They didn't flush out the other higher probabilities of who this could have been and should have been. It probably was, except for Richard Allen. I mean,
well, find me another case where you have the situation here. And look, I'm not saying Keegan Klein did it, but I'm saying, in my opinion, he's connected in some way, shape, or form to this. I don't know how. I don't know what. I don't know why.
So let's flush out in court. There you go.
Exactly. But why on earth the guy who was catfishing the girls, or one of the girls, literally had a plan to meet her where she died the day she died? And then 3 years later, he gets finally arrested and charged. Why it took like 3 years to arrest him, and they knew he had CSAM material, but it took them that long to arrest him. That's a whole other ball. And that's where that area. Area is where I think a lot, that's where the smoke is, and I think I would say there's fire is too.
Yes.
In that vicinity. And I don't know how it all plays together, other than I think, as we see with a lot of these folks who like material that involve kids, they're birds of a feather. And I'm thinking there's a lot of them when there's a lot of feathers that are being ruffled and they're flying about. But they got one of their low-hanging fruit. They got Keegan Klein in jail for the long period of time, rightfully so. But it took a long time to get him there, which was also kind of ridiculous, which is like, why did it take that long? You already had the knowledge that he was preying on young girls, and it still took you years to arrest this man. That's weird. And the fact that he was there talking to her and talking about meeting her that day. That's weird. But he's not. He has nothing to do with it. Totally separate charges. And it's just, it sits that way. None of it makes any sense. I mean, again, other than there's got to be some other people in this case higher up. I don't know who. I don't know where. I don't know if it's with the police. I don't know if it's with the judges. I don't know if it's higher up in leadership. I don't know if it's at state level or the local level, but there is somebody else here that doesn't want the light being shown on them, and they already got their scapegoat over here who's serving the time. Case closed. Stop looking. Nothing else to see here is really what it feels like.
So the horrendous thing that popped in my mind is, what's the likelihood and probability, unless you're a Duggar, that you have two people with that kind of background preying on children in that close of proximity?
What are the odds, Robin?
Unless you're a Duggar.
Unless you're a Duggar. Did you look it up? Do you have the odds?
Close to zero.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not to say it's completely impossible, but like,
look at the outliers, and then
you look at the interconnectedness of the other folks in the circle too.
There's always a connection. And this Alan had zero known connections. Zero connections came out in court to these two girls. Zero.
But there's all these other people who had connections to them who seem to like go on Facebook and reenact the murder scene.
Who are Duggarized.
Yes. I mean, it's just, it is such a shocking way of handling a case. Then you have, there's folks I know who are watching now who are new to this case. They're like, what about this? I wish we could give it to you all in one setting.
It's a lot.
But luckily, we've documented everything over the last however many years. So there's a gazillion pieces you can go back to and look at that we've done here. The police also, in case you're looking for another fun nugget on this, is the initial interviews with suspects, they taped over all of them and then said, no big deal.
Whoopsie.
We didn't need that anyhow.
Whoopsie doodles.
like all of the key suspects, like... Can you think of any investigation, Robin, where within the first 48 hours or 72 hours of folks that you interview and then you accidentally tape over, you're just like, no harm, no foul.
Not yet, although Nancy Guthrie came close, huh?
Yeah.
With mishandling of crime scenes.
Even if those folks have nothing to do with it, those are still going to be valuable pieces of evidence. You may not even realize till later.
This is the worst handled case I've ever seen, hands down. And it's not just the worst handled case; it's the worst hand. I mean, there's no justice here. And I know our great audience is chiming in on this. I know our whole team and Bob Mata is behind us too. And I looked up the probability before we came on of this appeal moving forward and working.
Yeah,
you don't want to know the odds.
It's not good. I know it's not good. I mean,
digits.
I mean, that's they got him where they want him.
Yeah.
And the reality and the sad, sick reality of all this, and it's not a reason to stop talking about it or stop fighting for it. But I mean, me and
100%.
I think we've all talked about this off the air, including with Bob. Where, look, if this does get traction somewhere, and there is. Finally, justice, meaning Richard Allen is getting granted another trial and a fair trial, and the evidence is actually able to be presented. What do you have left by the time this is said and done?
He was in such bad shape before, and it's going to be even worse now. You know, and again, I'm always victim focused. They really need. I don't know what they're feeling. I don't know what they've been through. And I don't know if they're completely satisfied with the state of things on Richard Allen, not thinking that there is any possibility. Or maybe that's what they have to tell themselves so they can move forward and live with. That's fine. But our system needs that kind of due diligence so that we have faith in the system that justice will be done. And it's just, this is such a glaring hole in that system.
I think I'm like, I certainly, you know, for Richard and Kathy, he deserves his life and his freedom, which have already been destroyed and stolen from him. But also importantly, the people who did this to him, the ones who did it with malice, and I believe there are some who did it with malice. I think there's some who just are along for the ride. They're doing what they're told. Yeah, I mean they're cogs in the wheel. But the ones who did do this ignorantly and willfully, even if it's willful ignorance, they need to pay. They need to be exposed. And if that's just losing your job, great. Because then you can't do this to other people and you shouldn't be in a position of power if this is what's going on, because God knows who else you're railroading, whether you think you're justly doing it or not. Because that's the problem with a lot of these folks. They think they're on the right side of this. I believe a lot of the police in this that are giving their interviews, that are getting rewards at, you know, Crime Porn Fest, you know, that's what I call Crime Con, Crime Porn Fest, because that's really what it is. You know, it is. And then they get get awards at this sort of shit. And then why don't I go to it? Well, there's one reason. That sort of stuff, when we're rewarding bad behavior and things, I'm not going to celebrate that. I'm not going to participate in that. But the thing is, people like that, they believe they are doing the righteous work because they're so caught up in their own bullshit. So some of these folks don't even see that they've done it wrong. I mean, but those are the folks that need to be stopped. Those are the folks that need to be removed from their positions of power. And if they can be prosecuted, very likely not, considering it's law enforcement and there's laws against that. At the very least, light needs to be shown on them, and they need to be exposed for what they did. And then let the cards fall where they may. But yeah, it's such a disturbing case.
Man, these three cases are just some of the biggest heartbreakers ones we've had. And Richard Allen's one. Every time his name comes up, I just keep going through his calls with his wife and his emotional state of trying to save her, always focused on her. You will not find any other jailhouse call like it. I haven't heard one. Anyone, I mean, and you compare that to the moron Duggar, you know, Joseph from behind bars. Look at me, look at me, look at me. His wife is dying on the other side, trying to get transfusions, and can't eat, can't sleep, and he's there. Oh, just read more Psalms; it'll feel better.
Psalms.
Just be like me. I'm forming a ministry over here. After I abused children, you know, I'm like, and then you have Alan. Where's the focus? I'm always like we said in the first block, you know, when assessing what's going on, before I look at the content, I look at the individuals to see what kind of credibility to give the content I'm about to consume. Mm-hmm. And when you look and do a deeper dive with the people involved, Richard Allen, his wife, his daughter, and every other character involved with this, before you get to, all right, now we'll look at this, you know, the evidence and data points, it gives you context of what you're about to consume as needing to be fleshed out or not fleshed out more. He does not fit a pattern of what he is behind bars for whatsoever. Now, granted, are there psychotic breaks that cause those things? Absolutely are. There is no psychotic break that's ever been recorded.
Yum. It's one of those cases where I feel like the justice will, the truth, I guess, will come to light, I think, at some point. I think it'll be long after the folks who are in power with Delphi have long gone and retired and are in the old folks' home. And they're, you know, getting their mice cream at night watching Wheel of Fortune and taking the pill cart. And at that point, they'll be like, who? And at that point, everybody's old and done. But there'll be another generation looking at this going, my God, look how horrible they handled this. And I hope so. I hope that the grandchildren of these investigators, in air quotes, are able to look back at what utter incompetent fools their grandparents were. And I hope they are scorned in their...
You got a lot of malice, don't you?
in their final years for their poor decisions that they made. Yes, I do. When I want somebody to be destroyed, I want them to be destroyed.
Yes, you too.
I'm going for the jugular. So there you go. I hope your grandchildren piss on your graves.
That's a moment.
That's going to wrap up this episode. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack. I've been so deep into this case. This is where I land.
I know.
It's where I land. I'm so contemptuous at these people because it's so angering. All right. Until next time. Robbins, by the way, his latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books. It'd be a good one for the Delphi Police Department to read.
Yes.
Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.